You're listening to the Incarcerated Christian Podcast, where we shine light on the dark side of Christianity and how it affects people and communities. I'm Robin Mitchell Stroud, and I'm here with my co-host, Deborah Levy Martinelli. We'll be covering a variety of topics, from individual survivor stories, including our own, to the influence of religion on our national politics. To learn more about the podcast, visit our website, theincarceratedchristian.com, or connect with us on TikTok and Instagram at The Incarcerated Christian, and on Twitter at @TICC_podcast_. Now, on to the show.
Our guest today is David Hayward, also known as the Naked Pastor. We'll get to that in a minute. David holds a master's degree in theological studies and diplomas in religious studies and ministry and university teaching. After 30 years in the church, he left the ministry to pursue his passion for art. He uses words and images to challenge the status quo, deconstruct dogma, and offer hope for those who struggle and suffer under it. David's art expresses the stories and struggles of spiritual refugees and independent thinkers who question, doubt, or oppose the confines of religion. Each piece, he says, encourages difficult conversations and acts as a catalyst for critical thinking. You can find David's work at nakedpastor.com. He also moderates an online community for the spiritually independent at thelastingsupper.com. Welcome, David.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Welcome, welcome.
Hi.
First of all, I have to ask, I think Robin knows the answer to this, but
I do not.
Why Naked Pastor?
Yeah, I get that a lot. Well, I bought the domain name nakedpastor.com way back in 2006, I think it was. And I just wanted to, that was when the Naked Chef, Naked Archaeologist, Naked Truth, things like that were popular. And the way I was blogging was I was letting people take a peek behind the curtain of ministry. I was in the ministry at the time, and I wanted people to see what it was really like as a real pastor without any of the, you know, success stories and all the growth and the wonderful sermons and music and converts and the wonderful warm fellowship and the kumbaya and everything. I wanted everybody to see behind the curtain and to see my struggles and the conflicts and my doubts and my fears and dealing with family and friends and all that kind of thing. So that's why I took on the name Naked Pastor, just because I want to be real, honest, raw, transparent, no adornment. Yeah.
David, your accent for our listeners, David is Canadian.
Yeah, actually, you have the accent.
That's right. We do. I was about to say, and I was about to add to that,
yeah,
that
right.
You actually attended, was it seminary in Missouri, which is, you know, one of our,
right.
One of the states near us, and you married a Southern girl in the U.S.
I did. Yeah, my mom, when I left for Bible college, said, don't you go marrying one of those Southern belles, and I couldn't have married any Southern than I did. I married a girl from the backwoods of Alabama. And we're still married, going on 41 years now. But we met in Springfield, Missouri, at a Pentecostal Bible college. And then when graduated, we went from there to Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary in Boston. And so I did spend quite a few years in the States. And I even planted a church in New Hampshire at one point. So, yeah, I'm not unfamiliar with the United States. So Lisa's actually American. I'm Canadian. We're living in Canada. And our three kids are dual.
Ah, that's great. Well, I first came to know of you through your cartoons, through your Twitter account. I just remember, you know, it's like one of those accounts that you come across that's so, I didn't even know. It was like water on a desert. Your cartoons are awesome. And for our listeners, his cartoons shine light on some of the problematic teachings and practices of, I mean, we could say that a Christian church, but really it could be any religion. And I love that you call yourself the graffiti artist on the walls of religion, and that you know that your writings and your cartoons are controversial because, of course, graffiti is. And so they're simple. I encourage everybody to go online and check them out. They're simple, but they're so like deeply complex and meaningful, but simple. I don't know. They're great. How so? And what it makes me think of too is like you're shining a light on what in our vernacular some of the imprisoning, you know, aspects of the church, and nobody gets out of prison without some level of trauma and spiritual trauma in this case, and your cartoons are, they just capture that so beautifully. And recently you've been doing quite a few on trans people and the relationship with the church. Deborah's got a favorite. I've got favorites. I really like the ones where you challenge gender and sexuality, but will you just kind of speak to some of your cartooning and how that became an outlet for you and
sure,
anything you want to add there? Yeah.
Yeah, I'd love to. Back when I first started, I've always been an artist, so I'd share my paintings, which are, you know, I do watercolor painting, landscapes and stuff, and I was writing, but I've always loved a good cartoon, like a one-frame cartoon, like, for example, The New Yorker. Some of my favorite cartoons ever are in there, and every year I buy any New Yorker I can find and, you know, the collections and so on. I just love the immediacy, the energy, the power, the punch that a good cartoon can deliver. And back in 2006, I was following another cartoonist, and I thought, it just dawned on me one day, why don't I try it? And because I'm an artist, I can draw and try to convey what I was thinking through a cartoon. And some of them are really terrible because it is a different art form for sure. But they just started catching on. And what's really cool about a cartoon is, you know, I could write a 1,000-word post and somebody could come to my blog and start reading and just get bored or disagree and move on or just scroll on by. It takes a lot of work to get somebody to read, you know, a post. But with a cartoon, with a few or no words, it's too late. You can't unsee it. It's like a split second, it conveys what I want to convey. And they say a picture is worth 1,000 words. And I think it really is true, especially for a cartoon. And so that's why I kept it up. I thought I would last a month. I challenged myself to draw one every day until I ran out of ideas. And here I am 16 years later still.
You still haven't run out of ideas.
No, I won't run out of ideas. I'm sure of that now.
Well, for people like me who were sort of raised in the traditions that you kind of challenge through your art, they're so affirming. That your cartoons are so affirming. But I'm also, the other part I like about it is that the way that you challenge is, it is in your face, but it's also very respectful. It's like respectfully in your face.
I hope so. It's interesting. I was talking to another fellow just last week, a friend of mine. He was saying, he was laughing at one of my cartoons. And he said, you know, like what's really cool about your cartoons is that they're not like mocking or like trying to hurt anybody or disrespectful. Like it depends on what side of the fence you're on the argument, but still it was respectful on both sides. And I really appreciate that because I do try to achieve that respect. So at the core of my message, I think, is the freedom of the individual to decide how to be spiritual, how to be themselves. And I critique people, ideas, and systems that try to prevent that from happening. And so yeah, my cartoons are going to be encouraging for some people, and or they're going to be offensive to some people because it's going to be challenging their attempts to control others and decide how they should live or whatever. So they do have that double-edged sword feel to them where they can cut to, you know, challenge something or cut to mend something and heal something. And I think that's another reason why I love the power of the cartoon.
It sounds like I'm a writer, so I come from that perspective, and I completely appreciate the picture is worth 1,000 words concept. I'm wondering if any of your cartoons are ever misinterpreted.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've made mistakes.
Can you tell us about one of those?
Yes, I can. There was one that comes to mind right now where it showed a woman kneeling and throwing up into a toilet. And she's throwing up all these religious symbols. So she's throwing up a cross and a church and the fish and John 3:16 and the Bible. And she's throwing all these things up. And I called it purge. And people who struggle with eating disorders found that offensive. like triggering. And so I learn as I go about, like, and I hopefully I do learn that that's an example where I learned conveying something and then using a word that's often associated with a struggle. I need to be careful and I need to be aware of that. So there's, you know, plenty of other issues and realities that I need to be very, very careful of. And so, for example, if I draw a cartoon that addresses LGBTQ issues or race issues or feminist issues, I will put it out there to my close friends who I trust, who are people of color or First Nations or women or trans or gay or whatever, and say, is this okay? Like, I want to make sure everything's fine. Here's what I'm trying to say. And a couple of times they've come back and say, no, don't say it like that. And so I really appreciate that when they help me out that way.
Nice to have your own focus group.
Yeah, that's exactly what they are. Yeah. Yeah, focus group.
Well, Deborah, I know you were curious about the Deborah's favorite cartoon of yours is the one of Jesus taking a selfie.
Oh,
and
yeah.
What was your inspiration for Jesus taking a selfie? I know I just took us on a left turn, but.
No, that's fine. Well, because, you know, you go through Instagram or Facebook or whatever, but I guess especially Instagram right now where there's so many people taking selfies. And I thought, I'm going to do one of Jesus taking a selfie, and what would that look like? And I decided to convey people of all colors and genders and race and religion, everything. It's one of my personal favorites as well. Although for some people, that's very, very upsetting, you know, that's not really, some people don't feel that's being accurate. So yeah, that's cool. That's one of my favorites as well.
I love it. And I find it particularly poignant.
Thank you.
Right now, as what's happening in Minneapolis is happening and across the country, for people to remember, you hear it all the time about what Jesus said and what Jesus did, but then you lose sight of that. So seeing that cartoon really brings it home again.
Mm, thank you. And, you know, I do other art as well. So, for example, I have my Sophia series, and I also have the Images of Christ. And I have several Images of Christ. Oh, there's a Liberation of Sophia book. Yeah.
So good. Yeah. We're going to get to that.
Thank you. In my Images of Christ series, I sort of fooled around with Mother Teresa's idea that she saw the face of Christ in every child in the streets of Calcutta that she was trying to serve and help and rescue. And so I sort of carried that further, that we could see the face in Christ in everybody around us, everyone, no matter what their gender or color or religion or age or ability or whatever. And I found that very, very, a very moving project. And so I decided I'd put them all together in a collage. There's 16 of them. There's actually more than 20, but I chose 16 to go in the collage. And, you know, I understand that concept. Oh, there's one where he's a refugee as well.
Mm-hmm. I love that.
Call that refugees. And there's so, I just can't understand why that would upset any, but there you go. You know, that it upsets some people. And some people get upset if you suggest Jesus was a person of color or that Jesus was an oppressed person and, you know, living as an oppressed person under oppression by the Romans, for example, and so on. And people just have real difficulty with that, especially white people. And so I find these very challenging and moving to create, but I know that they're going to stir up controversy at the same time. But that's what Jesus did anyway. So
I was about to say, yeah, that was exactly what he did. That is a powerful poster for anybody listening. Your Jesus collage is really powerful. I do want to get to, though, The Liberation of Sophia. It's one of your books. And it is a book. It's the stories and images of the journey of a woman struggling to achieve her spiritual independence. And the word that you use for that and that's commonly used for that is kind of deconstruction process. So it's kind of a dual question. I would love for you to, because you spend so much of your time helping people through their own deconstruction journeys. But the liberation of Sophia is also your own deconstruction journey. So would you just, you can jump in anywhere there. It's kind of a just very broadly introduce that.
Yeah. So my theological, I think there's two kinds of deconstruction. There's, in my experience and observing other people, there's a theological deconstruction where you start questioning your beliefs and maybe all of them. You might feel like you're losing your faith, changing your religion, losing your faith, whatever. So there's that theological deconstruction. But there's also the ecclesiological deconstruction or the church deconstruction where you change your relationship with the church. And my what I see is if you deconstruct from the church, you don't necessarily deconstruct theologically, whereas if you do deconstruct theologically, you're going to deconstruct from the church probably. That's what I see, because for many people, they just can't find a home, a spiritual home that allows them that kind of growth and that kind of space to explore and discover their own way of being spiritual. So for me, I had already deconstructed theologically, but I left the ministry in 2010. And that's when I got traumatized, because I was in the ministry for so long and served the church for so long. It was my vocation. Lisa and I worked as a team. Our kids grew up in the church, our friends, my paycheck, everything was associated with the church. And when I left the ministry in 2010, it took me about a year before I realized I needed help. And well, actually, my wife told me I needed help. And so I sought out counselors and therapists and coaches. And in 2012, I formed the online community, The Lasting Supper, for people like me who felt alone in their deconstruction journeys. And one Sunday afternoon, I was sat down and started drawing. And I've been an artist for as long as I can remember, but I had a pen and pencil, and I drew this picture of a young girl holding up a teddy bear to a grizzly bear that's towering above her on its haunches. And Lisa's like, my wife, she's like, what's that? Like, I've never drawn anything like that before. And I said, I don't know. I just drew it. Like, it was almost like a stream of consciousness. And then I called it Fearless. And for my wife worked weekends, nights. And so when she'd go to work, I'd open up a bottle of wine, get out my art supplies, put on some music, and just start drawing. And after 2 years, I had 62 images of this woman, Sophia, emancipating herself from oppression and feeling trapped to being and living as a free person. But it was about eight or so in when I was drawing the cave. There's a picture of a woman standing in front of a cave. And I realized, oh my goodness, I'm drawing my own story. This is my story. This is my soul represented by a woman, Sophia, which means wisdom in Greek. And this is my anima, my female aspect, my female side, my spiritual side, my seeking side, my oppressed side, looking for liberation. And I was actually documenting her journey through pictures and meditations. And when I was finished, I was finished. It was a weird, weird thing. I mean, it started just the way I described, and suddenly I knew I was done and I was free. I felt free finally. And so that's what the whole Liberation of Sophia book is all about, is that journey. And so many people, especially women, find it just resonates with them, because it describes their struggle to live free lives as well. Mm-hmm. That was long. Sorry about that.
No, that actually was amazing. And I was thinking as you were talking, David, that the chapter titles, the pictures and the information that goes with them, you kind of see that, because it starts with trapped and escape. And then importantly, and this was also part of my own journey, you move to like exposed and vulnerable. And then you kind of go through a defiance and rebel kind of phase. And then you've got a couple more that are like cleansed and resonance. Then it's like freedom and release. And then beautifully you end with, or near the end, is metamorphosis and light. It's like the whole, you just feel you going through the whole journey. And as a person who went through my own journey, like those more vulnerable elements, feeling exposed and feeling vulnerable. And because as you kind of said but didn't quite say. You actually lost quite a bit when you left your church, right? It came at a price.
Oh, yeah. So when we left, we thought everything was going to be fine. It was an amicable divorce, and we thought we'd be able to maintain a relationship, but things just got messy and complicated after, which they normally do. And we ended up walking away from our whole lives were wrapped up in the church, like things to do, activity, our friends, our community, our sense of destiny and purpose and mission and vocation and not to say my paycheck, my job. I didn't know what I was going to do. I felt totally thrown into outer space with no skills. And, you know, Lisa went back to university to start on her nursing degree. She started her nursing degree at 48 years old and graduated, you know, the oldest in the whole university that when she did graduate, but got her nursing degree. And our kids had left home, you know, empty nest. And we had to file for bankruptcy. It was like the perfect storm. And, you know, I know a lot of people experience that when they leave the church. That's one of the most painful things is the loss of community and all that. But piled on top of that was my own feeling like completely lost. I didn't know what I was going to do, how I was going to do it, how I was going to support ourselves and everything. So that was
like
a scary
being
time.
Unmoored, unmoored, just set adrift.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In another one of your books, The Lasting Supper, Letters for Deconstruction, which I also haven't read.
Too.
Love it. Oh, yeah. I'm a huge fan. Oh, wow. But anyway, one of the things that you wrote about in this, and for people who don't know, it's a compilation of letters that you wrote to your Lasting Supper community over the course of 4 years, I think, right?
Right.
But you wrote about how to deal with coming out to your family and others theologically. I'm not sure I've even ever done that completely with my family, frankly. I mean, certainly my nuclear family, but I'm not sure my extended family is aware, you know, of my, of kind of the depth of feeling and some of my experiences. But can you just, what advice could you offer to people who are kind of struggling with making that decision?
Yeah. So I haven't either, actually. Like all my family really know is that I'm very different. And nobody really asks, what do you actually believe about A, B, or C? They just know I'm different. And we've learned how to navigate those treacherous waters without hitting any rocks. And, you know, in order to stay in relationship, I guess. A lot of people do struggle with how to reveal who they are, become authentic, stand up for themselves or whatever, come out theologically, spiritually to their families. And I know how difficult it is. It's really frightening. It's really scary. But one of the main things I do talk about is, you know what? It's one thing to come out as maybe gay or as trans or something. That's because that's your identity. I mean, we're talking identity and sexuality and things like that. That's going to have to come out at some point, you might feel. Whereas spiritually, you can keep hiding for a long, long time and just not address it, just not go there. And it won't affect your life maybe a whole lot as it would if you were LGBTQ+, et cetera. One of the main things I talk about is, you know what? When we were in the church, at least the culture I was in, there was this pressure to constantly confess everything. You always had to be open and honest about everything. You couldn't have secrets. It was sinful to have secrets. And men's groups and women's groups, there was this kind of pressure to come clean, you know, all the time and confess everything and be totally transparent about everything about yourself. At least I remember that pressure. And now looking back, I realize that's not healthy. Neither is it normal. Like that's just not good. You should have secrets. You should have things that are just yours and fantasies or whatever. And for example, now Lisa and I have made new friends who have no idea, have no experience in the religious culture that Lisa and I experienced. And when we share some stories, they look at us like, what? Like they can't believe some of the stuff we were involved in when to us it was normal. But looking back now, I realize that wasn't normal. I mean, when you watch these are fascinating. When you watch documentaries on people who fled or escaped from cults, or the documentaries on cults, a lot of these people who've left, it's amazing how upset they are and how much they cry and how much they miss the intensity of the community. But they were being abused. Like there was serious issue, really weird stuff going on. And yet to them, it was normal and something they still missed, you know? But everybody else looking on is like, that's not normal. You know, you shouldn't do that. And you need to have more respect about yourself and so on. So that's the big thing when coming out to your family. You know what? Maybe they don't need to know everything.
I think that's a good point.
They don't need to know everything. You know, you don't have to divulge everything about your spiritual life.
Or defend your own, to have a
quiet, private life when it comes to your spirituality, I think. Well, that's number one.
That's great. I'm going to bounce that to another one of your books. This is my favorite one. Whoa. Questions are the answer. In fact, I'm wearing that shirt.
Oh, wow.
Questions are the answer. Like you, I was sort of raised in an environment where you hear a lot, you know, don't think, just believe, don't question, just believe. So much of it is like based in belief. And the problem with that for me is that I always had so many questions. And then I, not only did I not get answers to questions, but I felt really guilty for even having the questions, because somehow that signaled to myself that I was off the straight and narrow path, because my community was telling me that, which taps in, you know, which results in a lot of shame. So your book about questions are the answer, you write about three stages of questioning. And I found this so helpful, even after I had gone through my own kind of deconstruction process. I wish I had found this book on the front end of it, just because it different types of questions represent different levels of your kind of spiritual maturity. So I have more specific questions out of the book, but I'm kind of hoping you will just walk us through a little bit about the three stages of questioning.
Yeah, so this is really, really important. I came up with this for my own self, just to help me understand the different kinds of questions I might ask, because I've always been a curious kind of person and always asked questions. But early on in my spirituality, your questions are basically yes or no, black and white. So is there a God? Yes or no. Is the Bible inspired? Yes or no. Was the earth created in 6 days? Yes or no. It's just all black and white and yes or no answers. I call that the closed door. It's closed. Closed question. Yes or no. Then there's a swinging door, which is both yes and no. So is there a God? Well, yes and no. Is the Bible inspired and inerrant and infallible? Well, yes and no. I think the Bible is inspired, but I don't think it's historically accurate. I don't think it's a history book or text. I don't think all the stories are literal, but maybe metaphorical or mythological, etc. It's into that swinging door, yes or no, more gray. And then finally, it's the open door, where it's the open question, where what do we mean when we say God? Or what do we mean by when we say, is the Bible inspired? Was the Quran inspired? Is the Torah inspired? Is the Bhagavad Gita inspired, etc.? Was Martin Luther King Jr. inspired? And so on. So we start talking more openly about more things. So that's what I mean by the three phases of questions: closed, swinging, and open.
Mm-hmm. And the open is the part of the thing I like about the open is that sort of up to kind of our own discernment.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is just helpful. What we get to decide what. And I love your use of the word resonance too, because I just, you know, what I think my doctoral work is in looking at people who have, you know, been subjected to spiritual or religious and spiritual abuse and neglect, and just sort of how they move through that. And one of the things that they, that the people that I spoke with in my own experience and just reading, is that you're not allowed that ability to be discerning, because you're just told.
Right.
You're just told.
Right.
And that would be more of that closed door piece.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Deborah, you look like you're about to ask a question.
Actually, I was going to prompt you to ask a question.
Oh, good. What?
About the dreams.
Yes. Oh, I love this. Okay. So also in Questions Are the Answer, you shared what I would call these really pivotal dreams. The stained glass mask dream, the it's time dream, and the waterfall dream. And I love that you included dreams, because you write about them like I believe about them, which is they teach us. And I had a dream when I kind of knew I had gotten on the other side of my own deconstruction. I had a dream that I titled "The Worst Kind of Woman." The worst kind of woman, and you know, in parentheses, tells the Baptist Church to go to hell. And in my dream, I had dramatically, you know, like I told him to go to hell, and I flipped him the bird, and I dramatically walked out of the back of the church. It was beautiful, but I woke up going, oh, there it is. And so when you included dreams as sort of teachers, signalers for you, I just thought that was really great. And I'm hoping you'll share one of them and sort of share what you learned from it.
So that's really interesting. I forgot about that, but that's right. Dreams play a pivotal part. In fact, I have a school online, David Hayward courses or Naked Pastor courses. And in one of my courses is how to use your dreams for your own journey, because they've been pivotal in mine. Many years ago, when I took clinical pastoral education, I was introduced to Carl Jung. This is right after my master's degree. I became fascinated with Carl Jung. And that's where I learned about the anima, for example, and who Sophia is for me. I also learned about dreams. And what provoked that, though, was I had this powerful dream. I woke up actually feeling I'd met like God, like, or something. I thought I was going to die. Like, it was that huge a dream that I really felt I encountered something other that was so huge and terrifying. And the dream simply was, I was on a train, somebody opened a trunk, there'd been a murder or something, and they pulled out a stained glass mask, and a voice says, its name is Morpheus. And I woke up terrified. I didn't know who Morpheus was. I'd never heard of Morpheus. And I remember sitting on the side of my bed and just like literally shaking from fear and talking to my wife. She's trying to calm me down. And that was before we had internet. So I went to the public library. You know, I went into the university library and looked up Morpheus, and was the god of dreams. That just scared me more. And I started I was into Carl Jung and trying to, you know, pick that apart, trying to figure out what that meant. And then come to realize that my religious self was like a stained glass. It was something I was wearing on the outside. It wasn't who I was. And religion's like that, though. It's like a cloak, something we wear. And stained glass can be very beautiful, but it's still me underneath. And but for some reason, it was the god of dreams and then Morpheus. It took me a long time to understand that. And then
that is amazing.
And then another time I was in the Presbyterian Church. I hated my job. I was a pastor. I felt trapped and hopeless. Young kids living in the parsonage, felt completely, completely hopeless and depressed, didn't know what to do. And I had a dream that night where all I heard was a voice, it's time. And I woke up laughing my head off because I realized I'm not trapped at all. And Lisa started laughing, asked me what's wrong. And the kids came jumping in on the bed and laughing. And I said, we're not trapped. I said, I can just quit. And Lisa's like, okay. And we did. We quit and began a new leg of life, you know, a new adventure. And it was pivotal. That was a huge one moment lesson for me that I realized I'm never really trapped. I only feel trapped because I'm afraid of the consequences of acting out my freedom. I knew when I woke up, I realized, yeah, I'm going to lose the house, or I'm going to lose my pay. I'm going to lose, you know, my job. I'm going to lose this, and we're going to put my family at risk. But I'm not really trapped. These are the costs, though. But that I carried that with me now throughout the rest of my life. When I'm starting to feel trapped, I got to look and see what is it I'm afraid of. And then finally, my waterfall dream was where it was like an afternoon. I think I dozed off. Maybe it was like half in, half out. And I saw waterfalls, and I saw in a moment that we're all connected and deeply united at a fundamental level, that we're one, that there's one reality with many apprehensions of that and interpretations of that and explanations of that, but there's just one reality. I was mind blowing, and I felt immediate peace of mind that's never left. And it's wonderful. I know this is true. And now my job is to help that, you know, make itself more evident around me. So
that other people can share in that peace. Yeah. David, I had the same experience. I had withdrawn my membership letter from the Baptist Church, and my husband was worried for me. And there were reasons that I did that, but he was talking with a campus minister. We both work at a university. He was talking with a campus minister one day, and he was expressing his concern about, you know, sort of my beliefs changing. And this priest drew a circle and then spokes, and it's like a wheel. And essentially he said, you know, the core is the core. The core doesn't change. And then like all of these spokes represent different ways that people are trying to get at the core. And Clarkie came home to tell me that. And I'm not sure what he thought about it, but that was so freeing. And I had the same reaction. It was so peace-filled. Because I'm like, yes, that's all. But, you know, it's like, oh, you're going to hell if you leave the church.
Right.
So scary. Hey, can I ask you, though, before we switch to a different topic, that time when you were in the Presbyterian church and really struggling and you're in a leadership position, did you feel like a fake sometimes? Like a fake, or like if you're, I was wondering about that when you were talking about just struggling, but you're the leader and the teacher of a congregation, were you leading and teaching them things in a way that like you didn't believe? And if you were, like, does that make you feel like, sometimes I would feel like a fake. I'm saying this, but I don't really believe it. So I'm curious if you had that same sense.
I've never felt duplicitous. And I'll tell you why. I had another problem, and that was I wasn't loyal to any one denomination. I call myself my own ecumenical movement because I've been everywhere, and I have no problem, as we all know now, I have no problem quitting one and jumping into another. And I always tended to gravitate towards churches that wanted me. And we felt that we were going to be a good fit, and that I felt free to explore as I pastored, that I wasn't coming in as some sort of a guru top down thing, but that we were going to learn together. That was always my philosophy, even though in the Presbyterian church and other churches, yeah, they kind of elevate, you know, their pastors and ministers on a pedestal and so on. But I always resisted that. And so I always felt like I was pushing my own envelope and they were coming along with me, kind of thing. And so that, you know, I saw a picture once of a really beautiful picture of a shepherd with his sheep. And I think it was in the mountains of Afghanistan or somewhere, but just really beautiful, rustic. And the shepherd is kind of behind. The sheep are wandering, you know, eating, wandering, just finding pasture here and there. And he just wanders along with them. Very rarely do you see the shepherd out front and the sheep are following the shepherd. It's kind of like they're just kind of wandering together in the wilderness. And most of the time, I think they're kind of in the midst of them or behind them, you know, just making sure they stay away from danger. And that was kind of an inspiration for me on how to pastor, was just sort of be among them and wander along with them and not try to lead them in any certain direction. So I never felt like I was lying, but I did feel when I got to the place where I couldn't be me anymore, I quit. That's another problem, right? In my opinion, it's not a problem, But a lot of people see that as a problem where here I was pastoring the Presbyterian Church for so many years. And I'm like, I wake up from a dream and tell them, I quit. Right. 2 weeks, hand in my ordination papers and walk away. I mean, who does that? That's kind of crazy.
Yeah, not many people.
No.
That must be too why sheep show up quite a bit in your cartoons, right?
Yeah,
Deborah. Now I know you were about to ask.
They are quite popular.
Yeah, I love it.
Me too.
David, is there anything that you miss about your years as a pastor?
Yes, I miss. You know what I really miss is public speaking in a room of real live people. I miss that. I mean, I'm speaking with people every day all over the world, including you two wonderful people. I'm having a wonderful time conversing with you and sharing my ideas. But there's something wonderful about sharing my thoughts and having a discussion with other people in a room. I miss that. And especially since COVID, of course, that won't happen, but at least not here in Canada. But I miss that quite a bit, is the public speaking aspect of it and just the energy of the room, but also the community. You know, the church, that's its number one asset, is its ability to provide community, and nothing else can offer that. I know, because I've tried. And I'm not saying it's healthy or good. I'm just saying that's something that we do miss. I mean, what other organization can you walk in on a Sunday morning, husband and wife and three kids, and suddenly feel like you've got immediate friends, you're invited for lunch, you've offered babysitting, somebody offers to check your car, you've got activities every couple nights of the week, babysitters, you know, you name it, even prayer, support, people thinking about you.
Feels like one giant hug.
Right. Nothing else can offer that.
I one of my mentors in college, and this is really before I started examining myself, I just remember he became a mentor, was taking a class with him, and he was talking to the class one day about how he attends the church. He attended the church kind of down the street from his house. And he said, now, I don't believe what they believe. I go for the community. But at the time, I remember being so struck by that. It's like he said, they're good people. And that to me was like, I'd never thought that, oh my gosh, people go for the community aspects of it.
Yeah.
And there are people that I've spoken with just in my research where they, people assume that if you aren't happy with where you are in a church, that if you leave, you either leave and go to something more liberal, or you just leave that church altogether, or you leave that religion altogether. But I've spoken with people who actually moved toward more conservative brands of theology, not for the theology, but because of the community.
Well, I was talking to a woman recently who loves going to a local church that has all the bells and whistles and all the light show and dry ice and, you know, modern worship music and charismatic preaching and altar calls and everything. And she's an atheist, but she loves the show.
Interesting. She likes the show.
She loves the show.
We've got a lot of that where we live. Yeah.
But she would never dare divulge what she believes because she wouldn't be welcome there anymore. So she just loves sitting there anonymously and, you know, enjoy the show.
That's great. Yeah. If they found out that she was an atheist, in my neck of the woods, we joke about that would get you put on the Wednesday night prayer list and lots of visitations.
On the prayer list?
We call it the Wednesday night prayer list.
Oh, yeah.
The Wednesday night prayer list. Like sometimes that's legit, but sometimes it signals to the community that you are off the straight and narrow path. So it just depends on the tone that it's, you know, oh, we've got you on the Wednesday night prayer list.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. That's one of my cartoons. Let us pry.
Oh, yes. Let us pry. Oh, your cartoons are phenomenal. When are you going to put together? Oh, actually, you already have one. It's the one book I don't have. Put together a book of the cartoons. You've got it. One book.
Yeah.
Right,
well, Naked Pastor 101 was my first book of just cartoons.
That's the one I don't have.
But they're my earlier ones. I've improved since then. But I also have another one out called The Art of Coming Out, which are cartoons for the LGBTQ community. And I have somebody working with me right now, and she's trying to talk me into doing like a coffee table book of all my hits.
Like that size. Yes, I vote in favor.
Thick, maybe hardcover.
Bigger, thicker. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that'd be fun.
Well, and I know we don't have a whole lot more time left with you, but I would love it. I was thinking about, and I know Deborah's got, I know you want to ask your art question, but so this may, maybe this will be like a pivot to it. So you have cartoons, but you also mentioned that you do watercolor paintings, which you've got one behind you just over your shoulder, because I recognize
that's
it.
That's right. Yeah, that's one of my trees. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and it's all, I guess it's also spirit-driven, spirit-filled. I don't know how you would talk about it, but it's one of your primary outlets for expressing yourself.
Yeah, so I was talking with a person just this morning who wants to buy one of my watercolors and having a hard time deciding. But she's saying, "What I really love the ones where there's a solitary figure, tiny, tiny solitary figure in this huge landscape." And she says, and it doesn't feel empty. It feels full of presence. And I just love that description, because that's how I feel in the wilderness. That's how I feel in the world. I feel small, but I don't feel alone or abandoned or, you know, neglected. Like I feel the presence or presence. I don't know how you want to call that. I'm not necessarily invoking any divinity right now. I'm just talking about that fullness of oneness that I know that we are. I feel that. And I try to convey that through my paintings.
I think you do a great job of that. And I love that description, full of presence.
And that is a nice segue into the question that I want to ask.
Okay. Yes.
One of my favorite parts of your website is where you invite people to draw all over your art.
Oh, yeah.
Tell us about that and what inspired you to do that.
The coloring pages. Yeah.
Yes.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So there's sometimes people have offered to donate because they like what I do or whatever. And I thought, well, it'd be nice to give them something in exchange. So I created some just black and white drawn lines of some of my artwork that they can color in, coloring pages. Because coloring pages is now a thing for adults too, right? You knew that. You can get adult coloring books and so on. And so some of my images of Christ, for example, Let Them Eat Cake, or the Sophia one, Metamorphosis with all the butterflies, and ones like that, people can download those and use them to color. It's fun. In fact, I just got an email this morning from someone who did Let Them Eat Cake, and my version is it's a rainbow cake, and Jesus has icing all over his lips. He's enjoying eating the cake. And that was drawn in response to the news that a same-sex couple couldn't get a cake made for their wedding. And so I have Jesus eating the rainbow cake and saying, Let Them Eat Cake. So I just took out the color and provided that for people to color in themselves. So it's a lot of fun. Yeah.
I'm getting out my coloring pencils and I'm going to start going to town on those. They are fabulous.
Well, I see behind you, you have some really interesting black and white images. So you must have.
These are, I'm actually in a conference room at the university where we work, and these are historical photographs.
Ah.
We have hundreds of them all over campus, and we're very proud of them. So,
okay, cool.
Yeah, that's what that is. Well, I wish, and I know Robin does too, that we had more time to talk with you today. It's been absolutely delightful and enlightening and fun.
Yeah, it's been fun.
We're so grateful that you have agreed to join us today.
Well, thank you. And I just want to commend you to you're a really good interviewer. That was a lot of fun.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
I just want to personally thank you. When Deborah and I were thinking about guests, you immediately came to mind just because your work has been so helpful to me. Just in my continued journey, part of what I love that you talk about is that we're all on a continuous journey.
Right.
So thank you, David. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. And thank you. And nice to be with everybody out there in podcast land.
And in podcast land, listeners, please check out David's website, www.nakedpastor.com, where you can find his paintings, drawings, books, cartoons, greeting cards, art, and all kinds of merchandise. You can also follow him at Naked Pastor, on Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, and Facebook.
That's right.
It's very easy to, you just have to type in Naked P and he's the first one that pops up.
Yeah, don't yeah, make sure it's one word, Naked Pastor, two words, you're going to see things you can't unsee.
Well, that's a great tip.
I have not encountered that, but that is a good tip.
Yep.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Thank you for listening to the Incarcerated Christian Podcast. We invite you to rate and review our show. And remember, you can find this interview and others on our website, theincarceratedchristian.com, or anywhere you access podcasts. Don't forget to connect with us on Instagram and TikTok at The Incarcerated Christian and on Twitter at @TICC_podcast_. You can find more information about us and our show on our website. Again, that's theincarceratedchristian.com. Until next time, go forth in love and light.